It is so good to be with you guys. And in this session, we're going to be talking about the mind of Christ in an abnormal world. So here's where I want to start. We're going to talk about this issue of the mind of Christ in an abnormal world. Now, the place that I want to start is, I think the veracity of Scripture to me is convincing enough that the beauty of the way God describes the dynamics of our human experience is convincing to me. I don't have to be convinced elsewhere, but what I will say is that the chaos that you see, if you understand the way the secular world is trying to learn man, explain man, understand man, and all of his problems, it encourages me more that the Bible is very sane. And what you have to see if we're talking about this abnormal world, what I'm trying to do is to invoke in some way, I'm not trying to compartmentalize the things that we do in a spiritual section and then leave the mental health world into its own section. What I'm trying to say is that the reality that God presents in His Word gives us clarity to diagnose what is truly abnormal and helps us to understand what's truly healthy and what's truly normal. And it's our duty and job through the gospel of Christ and through the beauty of His Word to communicate that to humanity, to live that, to communicate that. And it's helpful for us personally as we live in life. So what I want to do is I want to start in this particular place. And listen, I don't know where all of you guys are on your understanding of secular psychology and how much you read things like that, but I want to introduce you to a couple things. And I've been reading, this is sort of a side hobby of mine. I enjoy reading what's called critical psychiatry. I enjoy reading secular theories. I enjoy doing that. I don't think that's prescriptive, so please don't take that as being prescriptive, like you need to do that. But I love reading those things. And let me start here. When you read a lot about the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, I've been reading recently a history of the DSM by Mark Horwitz. And this particular book, he's describing the transition from the DSM-1 and 2. He talks about how it was formed, and then he gets into the DSM-3. And the DSM-3 itself makes massive transition from really Freudian ideas of neuroses and psychoses to what we now know and what we're very much in the middle of in terms of what's called biological psychiatry. And what you need to understand is the DSM-1 and 2 was really not used very much. In fact, it's actually hard to find some of those early, like old copies, because it was just not used very much, maybe in an asylum for common language and things like that. But it was not something that was used popularly. It was even dismissed by lots and lots of psychiatrists. And the idea was we were wanting to explain human problems, okay, in terms of what's called psychogenic explanations, which is psychological problems, okay? And in Freudian world, it was neuroses and psychoses, and that's sort of how we delineate those things. And in the first one, there were 118, I think, disorders that were described in the DSM-1, and it grew, that was in 1952, it grew slightly. The DSM-1 was not the first what's called a nosology. A nosology is basically a way that we order human problems, categorize those human problems in the psychiatric world. The DSM-2 came out in 1968, slightly expanded, not really much updated philosophically, but something transitioned. So there were a lot of things happening, for example, in 1955. Psychiatry did not have a really good reputation in the early part of the 20th century. In fact, it was discovered that they were dehumanizing and mistreating people. To give you just one brief example, one of the reasons, it was America that taught Germany eugenics. And how did they do it? One of the primary ways that they did it was through psychiatric institutions, and some of that was discovered early in the 20th century. And then early in the 20th century, as we're trying to talk about problems, essentially what's happening is to be able to treat those problems in the ways that people thought you should treat them, you have to dehumanize somebody in order to treat them that way. Now, that may be an overstatement in some categories, I get that, but the truth of the matter is that was happening early in the 20th century. So much so that the ideas of psychiatry and the goals of psychiatry really begin to shift and change, and you see what we now know as mental health was born. It was born from an initial idea of what was called, what's the word I'm looking for? Mental, I can't think of it now.
What's the word?
Anyway, it's not that important. Clifford Beers was the man who created this title. It was picked up by the World Health Organization and later became what we know as mental health. What mental health is all about is trying to describe in human terms what we think is normal and abnormal. Are you following? Okay, so that's the summary. Just we're trying to come up with what is normal and what is abnormal. So as the DSM progressed, the 1950s, what we see is psychiatry comes roaring back because now, quote-unquote, medicines are discovered. 1950, 1955, you have medicines that are discovered. They were called minor tranquilizers and major tranquilizers. Maybe you remember that if you've been alive that long. And then in 1968, the second DSM, psychiatry starts to roar back. Well, it takes them a couple of decades, and by the time you get to 1970, building into the new DSM in the 1980s, you see a shift in philosophy. And the shift in philosophy is people started to realize our current system is not really substantial. It's not even scientific. So we have to do something that makes it more substantial. So the DSM-3 was born with a very different philosophy, a moving away from Freudian psychoanalytic leanings into now what's known as biological psychiatry. Biological psychiatry is simply built to explain man from naturalistic terms. And the idea, when you get to the DSM-3, 4, and now 5, we're on a 5TR, which is a revision of the DSM-5 currently, what you see is over 1,000 pages, nearly 500 diagnoses. These are categories that are described of quote-unquote human problems, and that's what the diagnoses themselves are. I say all that to say you can make your own decisions what you think about those things, but when you read, I would encourage you, just read the first 25 to 30 pages of the DSM, because in the beginning, what you'll see in the introduction is an explanation of what they're trying to accomplish. Now, they have a 1,000-page book, and in the introduction, one of the things that they'll tell you is, out of all these diagnoses, we do not know the etiology of any of those. What does the etiology mean? It means the cause of any of those. And so we have a 1,000-page book with nearly 500 diagnoses of what are called abnormalities. In the introduction, you never have an explanation of what's normal. Now, I find that very odd, because how are we explaining that which is abnormal if we've not set a baseline of what we think is normal? So I'll ask you that question, and maybe we can interact a little bit on this question. What does it mean to be normal? We could have hundreds of ideas of what we think it is to be normal. You probably didn't realize that there were distinctions in normality until you got married, right? Or until you went over to a kid's house for the first time and that they did things differently than you did. But definitely when you got married, because now you have to talk about all sorts of things. You know, what time dinner will be, what life is going to look like, how we're going to raise children, what we're going to value, where we're going to go to church, you know, all kinds of things like that. And you start to see, what I thought was normal, either I'm abnormal or you're abnormal, right? My point is, we have different ways that we describe what we believe to be normal and abnormal. And I think it's really important, in order for us to understand what that means, we have to have some sort of baseline to describe what it means to be human and what it means to be normal, a normal human being. Are you following that? Okay, now I want to shift gears because I'm going to come back to that idea. I think we should answer the question of this, because the mental health world, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to answer the question of what it means to be normal, or what should we categorize as being abnormal. And then from that abnormality, how do we fix it to make it a semblance of normal? Are you following that? Okay, so that's really one of the primary goals that they're trying to accomplish. A secondary question that's followed with this train of thought is, in the idea of mental health, is what does it mean to be healthy? What does it mean to be healthy? Now, we could give all sorts of explanations now, and with modern science, we could have all sorts of categories, you know, that you need to, your heart needs to beat at a certain rate, you know, a resting rate. You need to get a certain amount of hours of sleep every night. You need to have a certain type of diet with organic foods only, that include things like kombucha or whatever else it is that you, right? And that's what it means to be healthy. We sort